the reading from the New Covenant Scriptures for this week has been from the 11th chapter of Hebrews. Is anybody familiar with that chapter? Yeah? The by trust, by faith chapter. It's the whole book of Hebrews is actually a sermon. And not necessarily, it was probably not first a letter. It really fits the style of a homily. And in chapter 11, we get to a beautiful segment of the speech where the speaker goes into a creative, artful style instead of kind of a didactic style that's very much at the basis of what is being said in this book written to a group of Jewish believers. So we get into that poetic section of the speech. Imagine any of the great speech givers in history. The segment of, you know, where, for instance, the March on Washington, Martin Luther King Jr. is giving his speech in 1964, and Michaela, what's her name, Michaela Jackson, is there behind him, and she suddenly kind of speaks up, and she says, "Martin, tell him about the dream." And so he launches into this section. "I have a dream," and he, you know, every sentence begins with "I have a dream," and it becomes a high point for the entire speech. In a way, that's what the 11th chapter of Hebrews is about. It's the high point. It's the part that brings in the finale in chapters 12 and the first part of 13. It sweeps us into the conclusion in a really dramatic way. By every line beginning through faith. By faith, Abraham, by faith, Sarah, and he goes, or she, some scholars believe Hebrews was perhaps written by a woman, there's a pounding retelling of the history that has gone before. If you're familiar with the Psalms, this is typical. If you're familiar with other Jewish writings. This is a very familiar style where someone would go back and tell the history of what has happened before in order to make a point about the present. For instance, at the beginning of this section, we have, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of realities not seen. For by it the elders received commendation. By faith we understand." It's a nice little two-word explanation of what believing trust is. Understanding. By faith we understand. By faith we place our lives in the hands of the Most High. As we saw, as we read in the Psalms, that verse that says, "My heart will rejoice in the Lord because I have already trusted in His holy name." I can and will rejoice because I have trusted. I can understand because I trust in God. This is the definition of biblical faith. This is the definition of how we come into proper relationship with God. By placing our confidence, our trust in His name, in His reputation. In another place, it instructs us to trust in God's kindness. I love that idea. Trust in God's loving kindness. Faith is an understanding of who God is and that He is good to Israel, that He keeps His promises, even though we may not see or understand everything that He has given to us. And indeed, our teacher here is going to argue that that is the case for so many of the people listed. They never saw fully what God had promised. But through their trust, they keep walking anyway. The first person that was mentioned is the first son of Scripture, a guy named Abel. By faith, Abel offered a better sacrifice. By faith, Enoch was taken so he would not see death. Because without faith, it is impossible to please God. For one who comes to God must believe. It's not a head knowledge. We're going to see that as we move forward in the coming weeks through our study on Saturday afternoons in the book of Proverbs. It is not a wisdom, understanding, knowledge in the Most High, discernment. Discipline is not about what we know. A fool is not one with a lack of IQ. A fool is one who refuses to surrender to the Most High. Faith is a surrendering to the Most High. By faith, by surrender, by trust, Noah was warned of things that hadn't happened yet. But because he feared the Lord, he prepared an ark of safety. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance that he had never heard of, seen before in his life. But he moved because he was following the Most High. In verse 11, we come to the beginning of our reading for this week. It says, by faith, even Sarah herself received the ability to conceive when she was barren in past age, since she considered the one who had made the promise to be faithful. There's some amazing words wrapped in that one verse. By trust, Sarah falls in line. I love the fact that along with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, we have one of the matriarchs listed in this part of the sermon in Hebrews. By faith, Sarah received the ability to conceive, though things didn't add up in her life. And though there was no way that she could see through on her own, she received the ability to conceive through faith. Remember, she laughed? Yeah, sometimes we're guilty of that too. Yeah, God, like, really? But yet she's included. I read one commentator that actually said that it went so far as to say Sarah doesn't deserve to be in this list. And the text was edited to write her out of the text. That this verse actually refers to Abraham and Sarah's just mentioned parenthetically. But doesn't our author go on to speak of others that, I mean, we'd look at and go, wait, they're major screw-ups. Did you know Samson is in this list? Jephthah? David? Do they deserve to be examples of trust in God? Samson, really? And so I actually appreciate the fact that Sarah is included, that Sarah's on the list, that though she laughed, there could be a rebounding of trust in her life. And indeed, it tells us in Genesis that God came and visited her, and he brought her a gift, a son. And she laughed again, we're told. That laugh was very different than the one a year earlier. A laugh of joy, a laugh of recognition that as this verse in Hebrews says, that she considered that the one who had made the promise would be faithful. Though she laughed, there's an understanding and a confidence that God is faithful. It's one of God's attributes that we need to be aware of every moment, every day of our lives. That he is chesed v'emet. He is kind and he is true. I love the fact that the chesed comes even before the emet. It's not that he's just and true and then kind, but he is kind, chesed, and then faithful and true. He operates his truth through his kindness. And that's what he did for Sarah. He was able to forgive Sarah's laugh. No, this isn't going to happen to me, she thought. But yet, in God's kindness, he came through faithfully in his truth for her. She realized that God's promises would stand. So that, verse 12, so that the one being as good as dead were fathered offspring as numerous as the stars of heaven and as uncountable as the sands on the seashore. This is actually a quote from this week's Torah portion in chapter 32, verse 12. As Jacob was coming back into the land, God appeared to him at the same place that Jacob had encountered God when he left. And God said, and actually Jacob recounted it to God, God, you have promised that I would have descendants as numerous as the stars, as uncountable as the sand on the seashore. At another place, it's really great, later in the book of Genesis, it says that Israel would multiply like fish. Toward the end of the book of Genesis. It's a rather interesting and a somewhat, to me, funny description. I'm much more familiar with the mentioning of the stars. But Israel would increase and grow in number. And it's interesting that God kept his promise. It actually happened while they were in Egypt. In exile is where Israel grew into a nation. And God was faithful to his promise. Sarah, Abraham never lived to see it. They lived to see one, Isaac. But they understood that God was faithful, that God was not going to give up on his promises. Indeed, this is what verse 13 addresses. All of these died without receiving the things promised. But they saw them and they welcomed them from far away, afar off. And they confessed that they were strangers and sojourners on the earth. the promises were always out of reach. They couldn't be produced fully by their own actions, just by following the Most High. But there was a recognition and a holding on to God's faithfulness. It says that they confessed that they were strangers and sojourners on the earth. This is a quote from Abraham himself. At one point, Abraham, when he was buying that field with the cave to bury his wife, he told the Hittites, he said, "I'm just a stranger and an alien here among you." It's interesting that he uses that language because God had promised Abraham this entire land. But yet he calls himself a stranger and an alien. In fact, the only property that Abraham ever owned was a cave. And it wasn't even a cave that he was going to live in. It was a cave that he used to bury his wife. The only property that he ever owned from the promise of descendants and land was a burial site. In fact, even by the end of the book of Genesis, there's only one more burial site added to that, where the Joseph will end up being buried at Shechem, at the end of the Torah. Where's the promise? But yet there was a confidence that God was faithful. We're sojourners and aliens. We have a promise. We recognize that that promise hasn't fully come to pass. There is an attitude of we will continue to be strangers and aliens. In fact, this is what 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11 says. Shimon Kefa reminds the Jews that he's writing to, you are to continue to consider yourselves, and he uses the same language that Abraham uses in Genesis 23. 1 Peter says, you are strangers and aliens on the earth. Strangers and aliens. You've received the promises. You have Messiah. But in a way, the new covenant promises aren't complete. Have you ever thought about that? Despite the fact of having Messiah, despite the fact of being given the promise, we're still waiting for their completion. We're still waiting for them to come to their fullness. But yet we continue and we press on. We push on in trust in the Most High. What we have might be as small as the promise of receiving the graveyard. It's not much property, and it's not a place you want to live. But yet, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, they trusted in the Most High. Interesting. This is a little digression, but I came across that something interesting as I was studying this passage. Considering what it means to be strangers and aliens, here Hebrews tells its Jewish believing readers that they should consider themselves like Abraham, strangers and aliens. Peter tells his Jewish readers that they are to consider themselves strangers and aliens, whereas Paul uses that same language for Gentiles in Ephesians chapter 2. He says, Gentiles, you have come into the commonwealth of Israel. You are no longer strangers and aliens to God's promises and covenant. So in the New Covenant scriptures, as we've seen before, there remains a distinction, even in Messiah, between believers, Jewish and non-Jewish. Jews are to consider themselves strangers and aliens. Gentiles are to recognize that they are now no longer strangers and aliens. They have received the promise. I'll let you chew on that. If you want the verses to peruse that, I can give those to you. They could do all of this, verse 16, because they yearned for a better land, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared a city for them. I was struck by this phrase. I even mentioned it to my wife at one point. It says that they yearned for a better place. A heavenly place. I think this is Jewish Jewish way of referring to the Most High. We're not talking about Platonic elements of physical versus spiritual, and split it, you know, that they were only interested in spiritual things and not interested in the physical promises. That is not a biblical concept. That's a Greek philosophical concept developed by the Greek philosophers such as Plato that separates, well, some things are just physical and other things are spiritual, and God doesn't care about the physical things. He only cares about the spiritual things. This is a very unbiblical perspective. It doesn't mean that they weren't interested in living out and receiving the physical promises. It doesn't mean that the physical promises didn't come to pass. But what they were walking toward in their trust was a recognition that there was a greater and additional fulfillment to God's promises. Over and over, we're told that the promise of the land, which began with Abraham, and extends to this very day, that it was more than just about terra firma. It was more than just about fields and property. The promise of the land had spiritual and relational elements built into it that God gave, that where the land became a sign of the rewards that God gives those who walk with Him and trust Him. Indeed, as Israel would walk away and begin to follow their own directions and follow where their own eyes were looking, the gift of the land would begin to crumble. And in fact, at one point, Moses even said, the land will spit you out because of your deeds. But what did God do? He brought the circle back around and says, I'm bringing you back to your land. I'm bringing you back home. So the land is central to the promises and the relationship with the Most High. I said all that as a way to emphasize in our tradition, we don't dichotomize between the physical and the spiritual. They're wrapped up, twisted with one another. One supposes the other. So there are rewards for walking with the Most High. I was studying for something else this week and read one commentator that wanted to insist that anytime we seek rewards, we're missing the boat. Anytime we expect that God will reward us, and I was going, I guess you don't understand your scripture. God, we're told right here, is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. And then this one other phrase. God was not ashamed to be called their God. After going through all this discussion about faith and trust and promises and how God is faithful, there's this amazing statement in verse 16. Because of the way they held on to God's promises, He was not ashamed to be called their God. My mind went to a story that Yeshua told about how if someone is ashamed of the Most High, if someone is ashamed of Messiah, that the Most High will be ashamed of them. But here we have the example, the picture. What does it mean for God to not be ashamed of us? God is not ashamed of us as we hold on to the promise, as we trust in Him, as we follow Him, as our heart, the heart of our people, is open to Him. He is not ashamed to be called their God. I love the way that God named Himself. God has lots of interesting names. One of God's names, and we even recited it in the Amidah, is the God of Abraham, the God of Jacob, the God of Isaac. God named Himself after those who trust in Him. I am the God of Israel, the Holy One of Israel. God names Himself after Abraham. God names Himself after Isaac. God names Himself after Jacob because He's not ashamed to be called their God. I love that. God's identity is wrapped up with our faithfulness to Him. As we are faithful to Him, we begin to understand what it means that He is our God. We begin to understand what it means that He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That He's not ashamed to be called our God. In the week ahead, I encourage you to reflect on, am I holding the promises of God Cain didn't. Esau didn't. And in fact, their names are even mentioned in this chapter as a negative example. How are you holding the promises of God? Is your heart trusting in His kindness? Is your heart following? If circumstances be it illness, finances, business, if circumstances are clouding that, be encouraged. God is faithful. Don't let God be ashamed of you. It's a tragic, heavy statement. Don't demonstrate your shame for the Most High by letting your trust diminish.